away and said to one of the officers as he moved on, "See that these gentlemen are looked after and taken to my bivouac. Let my surgeon, Dr. Leray, attend to their wounds. Au revoir, Prince Repna." And he spurred his horse and galloped away. His face was radiant with happiness and self-satisfaction.
So War and Peace is partly about that relationship between huge events and individuals and how the two mesh together. And the book has a kind of philosophical angle on that as well, doesn't it?
Well, yes, yeah. When Tolstoy was researching the book, he read every history of the 1812 invasion, both in Russian and in French, and he wasn't very impressed by them, actually, because they all emphasised the overriding importance of great men. And Tolstoy believed that great men were of very superficial importance and that their power was often illusory. And he believed that the great change in history is driven by myriads and myriads of ordinary people doing apparently quite insignificant things. And, you know, part of his... all of his ambition in War and Peace was to give a sense of that swarm of humanity taking these tiny little decisions, often in ignorance of what was happening, and how those tiny little decisions come together and produce radical change.
It's funny, though, isn't it, as well, that we tend to associate this kind of novel with 19th century writers. But I don't think that's correct, because you think contemporary novels can be and are as ambitious. Think of things like A Suitable Boy or Midnight's Children or your trilogy. So somehow we can be as ambitious, can't we, in the 20th and 21st centuries?
Yes, and I think... I don't know whether Tolstoy is being very daring and breaking the rules. I think perhaps he was making the rules as he went along, as a, you know, a genius of that stature can do.
Do you think this is the point where it's difficult for us as non-Russians to get something? Because all that love that you have in lots of Russian literature with the peasantry,
yes,
and, you know, living close to the land and all that stuff about, I mean, even that stuff about nature, I mean, why he likes peasants, is there a part of, and you get this, this is a sort of conversion experience, isn't it, that we have in this reading. And part of the conversion is that he suddenly sees the sky, feels a part of the nature of things. And there's something about that you get here, the Russian soul is close to, through the peasantry, is close to nature. There's something there that, I guess, I live in the Elephant and Castle, so it
yes.
just, it isn't something that really, it doesn't really sort of grip me. But there's something there I see as quite distinctive.
I would certainly agree with that. I can't think of any English novel. Adam Bede, perhaps, would be the closest, where there's the same sense of it being beneficial to get in touch with the common people. I don't think it's something we have, but then we didn't have a system of slavery, which, of course, at this stage, they still did. It had been only recently been abolished when Tolstoy was writing the novel.
And we don't only read them through the prism of history, we also read them through a kind of fog, if you like, of translation. And what do you think we're missing by not reading them in the Russian? Oh,
I would need to speak Russian to know what we were missing. I mean, I think you always know when you're reading poetry that you're probably missing at least 80 or 90% of what the poet originally wrote. But I think in novels it's quite difficult to know what you're missing, and I think it probably varies very much from novelist to novelist.
And you also get, I mean, the other difference that separates us from both of these authors is something about the Russian Orthodox Church, the importance of faith to these people, that things like icons for Dostoevsky, for the church, how that sort of bleeds into nationalism. That is something that when we're reading it now, especially in sort of secular 21st century, that really puts many people at a distance from this. They can't see what all the fuss is about, why it's such a drama. And yet for them, it is, in a different way, life and death stuff. I mean, Tolstoy wants to... I always think of Tolstoy as a bit of a rationalist. He wants to sort of get some sort of order handle on everything. Dostoevsky is much happier to let things go, but they're still responding to a similar sort of problematic, I guess.
I think that is also part of the Victorian experience in England, though, this sense that if there isn't a God and there isn't immortality, then there is no reason for anybody to live a moral life. But then, as George Eliot said, there is no God, and yet we must be good. But, you know, you don't have to agree with her.
So, very briefly then, at the end, these are seen as difficult books. People are put off by the vastness of them. They're tough to finish. Can I ask each of you for your advice to a beginner? Charlie, if you're starting off, where what would you begin with?
Well, I've got to tell you, I'm a terrible reader. I'm a really terrible reader. And so I really am... I mean, I have to tell this terrible secret, I'm on the radio, but I've just bribed my daughter with cash money to read Anna Karenina. So I just wanted to go and read it. So there's... But once you just immerse yourself in it, for me, the reading is actually quite difficult. But the ideas that flow out of it, they last a lifetime.
All right, and Pat, would you offer money?
Well, no, but I'm going to say something even more shocking. When you're dealing with something of the size of War and Peace or the Brothers Karamazov, why not buy yourself some of these lovely little cliff notes or sparks notes which people use as crammers when they're working for an exam? Simply because they will give you the lines of the story. And it's certainly not a substitute for actually reading and immersing yourself in the work, but they do act as a kind of map.
I used to love those. Classics Illustrated.
Yes.
Remember them? Little comics. War and Peace in 16 pages. Thank you very much to my guests, Giles Fraser and Pat Barker, and to our reader, Melanie Gray. We've been discussing The Brothers Karamazov and War and Peace, which I hope you'll all go off and read before tomorrow. Thank you very much.
It's going to take longer than that. Ian McMillan presented this evening's Proms Plus literary event, and the producer was Laura Thomas. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. I'm Andrew McGregor, live at the Royal Albert Hall, where we're about to hear the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra reliving the Siege of Leningrad in a performance of Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, his Leningrad Symphony, conducted by Andris Nelsons. And we'll hear what the orchestra's Latvian music director thinks of the piece in a moment or two. But I'm joined right now in the presentation box by the orchestra's chief executive, Stephen Madigan. Stephen, we're four seasons into Andris Nelsons' stewardship of the orchestra, and there's still a real buzz about the partnership. How would you say they've changed, evolved over the last 4 years?
Well, I think, of course, orchestras have to continue to evolve to survive. For us, that's been a lot of it has been to do with the repertoire we play. So these big Russian and German pieces, a lot of opera, a lot of Wagner, which is one of Andris's passions. We played the complete Tristan and Isolde earlier this year, which is the first time the orchestra had ever played it. That was an amazing experience, you know, life-changing thing for people.
It's such a thrill for symphony orchestras to get their teeth into that kind of repertoire.
Fantastic.
They just don't get it the rest of the time.
Absolutely. We're doing The Flying Dutchman next year. So opera has been a strong thing, and because Andris is such a great opera conductor, but also it's about the way of playing, and you'll hear in this Shostakovich there's just a kind of no holds barred, no prisoners way of conducting, which takes a little while to adjust to for new orchestras, but now is just so thrilling for us that every performance feels like an event.
Well, they're coming onto the stage as we're talking. Just very, very briefly, I know it's a really busy summer. Where are you heading next?
Well, the next thing for us is Edinburgh Festival next week for Sibelius 2 and Goodbye Dulina, and then a four-concert residency at the Lucerne Festival in Switzerland. So, again, big pieces, Mahler 2, Beethoven 9, and Shostakovich. So, great honour for us to be there for a residency, and very exciting place to be.
Stephen, thanks very much for joining us. It's great to have you all back at the BBC Proms. Well, let's find out right away exactly why this dynamic young conductor liked Shostakovich so much, and especially his Seventh Symphony.
Everything he writes is a genius work, whether he writes for films, theatre, for string quartet, for symphony orchestra or opera. In my feeling, I would call him Russian Mozart, you know, because everything Mozart wrote was really a masterpiece. And I think the same with Shostakovich. Any piece you take, it's a masterpiece. And therefore, it shows to me that we sometimes over-politicize his music. It is also a music just genius by itself, even if there was no war. And this piece, one of these victory pieces where it ends so powerful that there is no chance that Hitler would have won the war. I mean, after hearing this symphony...
Andris Nelsons, as far as I know, Hitler didn't hear the Leningrad Symphony, but some of his soldiers certainly did, as it was broadcast to them on loudspeakers from the besieged city itself. But Shostakovich wrote in his original programme, though, that he hadn't composed so-called battle music. He wanted to convey the content of terrifying events, which he does after the first movement's opening theme with the so-called invasion theme that begins with the rattle of the solo snare drum and builds inexorably, a march using musical ideas from Shostakovich's own opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, and from Lear's operetta, The Merry Widow, which is reputed to have been one of Hitler's favourites. Shostakovich called the central part of the first movement a requiem for the heroes who died for us. The symphony's two middle movements originally carried the titles Memories and The Homeland's Vistas, and the finale ultimately delivers the triumphant return of the symphony's opening theme, Battered but Unbroken. And to transport us to the Siege of Leningrad in 1941, here's Andris Nelsons to conduct the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
A triumphant C major ending to Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony. Well, if it is at all, it's desperately hard won. Shostakovich capturing that combination of hope, despair, and grim determination that he felt in one of the longest sieges in history and perhaps the most destructive. You've just heard Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony, performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by its music director, Andris Nelsons, and greeted by a proper Proms roar. Here he comes back to the platform. Asking some of the members of the orchestra to stand for their individual calls. Piccolo player Andrew Lane, Fortis Mary Christine Zupacic, clarinetist Nicholas Carpenter. We shouldn't forget the little shrill E-flat clarinet, one of Shostakovich's favourite, one of the secrets of that wind sound in so much of his music, played by Joanna Patton. And the bass clarinetist Mark O'Brien standing there, providing that deeply satisfying solo in the second movement of the symphony. Bassoonist Greta Tulls. The horn section. We've got two horn sections, in fact. We shouldn't miss pointing out that Shostakovich actually has two separate brass sections. One in the conventional position over to the right behind the winds. The other's high up behind the percussionists. Stage left, just standing, all of them, that second brass group, to take their own bow. And that roar, of course, is for the solo snare drum player, Adrian Spilett, from the seven-strong percussion section, three of them playing snare drums in the Invasion March section. The harpists and orchestral pianists getting their turn in the spotlight. I think everybody's going to be taken one at a time and given their own share of the limelight, the timpanist now. And we shouldn't forget the CBSO's leader, Lawrence Jackson, for his solos, the strings standing now. And I mentioned that a performance was broadcast to the Germans besieging the city of Leningrad. They actually managed to mount that performance with the last remaining emaciated musicians of the city's radio orchestra, just 14 or 15 of them who haven't been evacuated or sent to the front. They were joined by musicians from the trenches, and they managed to broadcast it on loudspeakers around the city in August 1942, and they made sure that the Germans fell silent during the performance by ordering a bombardment of German artillery positions before the performance. Well, that was actually after it was given its first performance in the West in June that year with Sir Henry Wood at the Proms. Andris Nelsons back on stage, and they're going to be back home in Birmingham on Thursday in Symphony Hall for a concert of choral music by Brahms and Beethoven. They've already recorded the Seventh Symphony, by the way, so keep your eyes and ears open for it on CD. And you don't have to wait long for your next Shostakovich Symphony here at the Proms, his 10th on Thursday from the Royal Liverpool Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Vasily Petrenko. I'll be presenting that one, so I very much hope you'll join me here in the Royal Albert Hall in 2 days' time, live here on BBC Radio 3, of course, the home of the Proms. Where this evening, as the CBSO stands to roars from the promenaders, we've enjoyed two pieces written 60 years apart, each in its own way, connected to sieges three centuries apart. Well, here at the hall, we're free to leave, but locked into Broadcasting House for the evening is Ian Skelly.
Happily so, I must say. Andrew, thank you very much indeed. That was Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. Always very special to hear that symphony at the Proms, making history every time it's played, it seems. Well, there's a chance to hear the whole of that concert if you missed some of it on Monday the 3rd of September during Afternoon on 3. That begins at 2 o'clock. Or, of course, you can listen to it on the Radio 3 website, where you'll also find a fascinating conversation with Andris Nelsons, which made up this week's Lebrecht interview last night, in fact. Extraordinary journey he's made so far in such a short space of time. Birmingham is very lucky indeed that he's just renewed his contract with the CBSO. Well, tomorrow night we have two proms for you. The first is given by the London Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Valery Gergiev, a powerful advocate of the work that you'll hear tomorrow night. You may have heard him talking passionately about it on In Tune this evening, which is also something available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website and very much worth listening to if you didn't catch that conversation. The music is by Prokofiev. It's his ballet Cinderella, and we're going to be live at the Royal Albert Hall at 7 tomorrow night for that concert. Then we'll be back there at 10:15 for a late-night prom. I Fagiolini celebrates music that is roughly 400 years old by a variety of early Italian composers, among them Gabrielli, Monteverdi, Viadana and Bassano. That's a late prom tomorrow night, live here on Radio 3 at 10:15. Well, we have more live music to come tonight on Radio 3, not from South Ken, but from the heart of the Edinburgh International Festival. Late Junction will be coming live from Edinburgh tonight, and you can hear performances by the Mercury Prize nominee King Creosote and classical guitar music performed by John Etheridge. Much more besides two, all from 11 o'clock tonight here on Radio 3. And in the meantime, we're going to head to China. Isabel Hilton will be your guide around the many brand new museums in China. There's a big boom in museum building, apparently, sparked by a growing interest in contemporary history. Between 8 and 10 million artefacts from China's recent past are going on display. What sort of things are they, though, and why are they suddenly so attractive to visitors? You can find out at 10 tonight. To take us there, we have more music. I've a recording of Gergiev in just a moment, conducting one of his other great passions, Wagner. But first, to soothe the mood after such a monumental orchestral climax, something a little softer from Schubert. Thank you. A Fugue by Schubert, music for two pianists, who were, in that case, Paul Lewis and Stephen Osborne. As I mentioned, tomorrow night's first prom is given by Valery Gergiev, conducting the London Symphony Orchestra, conducting the ballet score to Prokofiev's Cinderella. Well, by way of a prelude to that, I thought we could hear him conducting a prelude now, not to a piece by Prokofiev, but by Wagner. This is the prelude to Wagner's last epic music drama, completed not long before he died in 1883. Gergiev is conducting the orchestra of the Mariinsky Theatre in this live recording of Parsifal. The prelude to Parsifal by Wagner, played by the Mariinsky Theatre Orchestra, conducted by the man in charge of the LSO tomorrow night at the Proms, Valery Gergiev. Prokofiev's Cinderella, live here on Radio 3, tomorrow night at 7.
On Radio 3, Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. At 1 o'clock, Christina Schaefer performs Schoenberg's Pierrot Lunaire. At 3, a journey to the far corners of our musical world with the gospel vocal group Blind Boys of Alabama. Amazing grace. And at 8 o'clock, Prom's favourite John Wilson recreates the Broadway sound with the help of his hand-picked high-octane orchestra. A packed Bank Holiday Monday at the BBC Proms. Hear it all live on BBC Radio 3 from 1 o'clock.
It's 10 o'clock now and time for the first of two features on Radio 3 this week that take us to China. As the country continues its dramatic modernisation, Isabel Hilton reports on the changing ways that history is being presented and used in China's museum building boom.
A sentimental ballad performed by Fan Jianchuan, former soldier, one-time mayor, property developer, and now founder and proprietor of the world's largest private museum complex. Mr. Fan does nothing by halves. He's wearing military camouflage trousers and combat boots, and his chauffeur is driving us on a whistle-stop tour of his first 15 museums. He's playing me his own CD, a kind of Desert Island Discs, with Mr. Fan singing all the songs and playing all the parts. It would take at least 2 days to get around Mr. Fan's museums properly. We stopped briefly at the Footbinder Museum, the Anti-Japanese War Museum, an astonishing building containing only clocks and several devoted to the Cultural Revolution. I've looked into the vast warehouse where millions more objects and documents are waiting to be sorted, catalogued and displayed in the next wave of museums, planned for this huge ex-military base in rural China. Fan Jianchuan is a whirlwind of museum creation, but he's also straining at the limits of what can be said about some of the darkest times in China's recent past. He's trying to tell China's terrible 20th century as he sees it, rather than reading a government script. His museum complex would be extraordinary anywhere. In China, Fan Jianchuan is charting a new path in the public exploration of history. In this programme, we look at how history is used in China, the changing relationship with the past, and how the Communist Party wants its people to understand the contentious events of the 20th century. What is the party's relationship now with China's long and complex history? And can private efforts like Mr. Fan's really influence the way China sees itself? This, after all, is a country in which museums have traditionally had a very clear story to tell. Not so long ago, the place I'm standing in would have been what you might expect to find looking for history and the way it's presented in China. It's a museum, but one with a message. It's the mansion of the wealthy Liu family in the countryside in Sichuan province, and in one of its 27 courtyards stands one of the most iconic artworks of Chairman Mao's most radical years, a series of life-sized clay statues depicting the cruelty and exploitation of the Chinese peasant by the wicked landlords. This is Rent Collection Courtyard, created in 1966, a year before the Cultural Revolution, to put a revolutionary stamp on this historic mansion. But history in China is a moving target, loud in some places, full of silences in others. Today, China wants to forget the radical years, and there's something missing from Rent Collection Courtyard. In 1970, a further set of clay figures was placed in the courtyard next door to tell how the Communist Party captured the landlord and led the peasants to revolution. It was never quite true. This particular landlord died before the communists arrived, and today the statues are gone. A notice on the wall says they were damaged by natural causes. All that's left is a rising tide of red flags on one wall and a picture of Chairman Mao. In China, as Chairman Mao once put it, history must serve the present.
We want our students to know that in modern China, the major goals of our ancestors is to build a strong democratic country.
Beijing history professor Wang Xianming explains how history is taught to today's students in China.
We have no more emperors, we have new governments, we have a new state, and science and technology become more and more important in daily life.
So history still has a message, but today it's no longer the triumphant march from oppression to communist liberation, but the ambition to build a strong, modern and technologically advanced China. In Chairman Mao's time, his story dominated the presentation of history to the exclusion of almost everyone else. But now, according to Wang Hui, one of China's most influential historians, even Mao's old Nationalist Party rival is being given some credit.
The past for China is always the field for the arguments. Like sometimes Mao was the great hero, but now the people also try to retrieve the history of Chiang Kai-shek. All these different kind of the peoples that became the topic in the contemporary context.
At first glance, then, China's history is much more open as a result of the last 30 years of economic reform and opening up to the world. In many ways, it seems like the West, historians getting to grips with the present through an open-minded exploration of the past. But scratch the surface a little, and it looks very different. Many academics and historians seem afraid to discuss the no-go areas, the limits to their research that are set by the government's official narrative of Chinese history. It's a field that still seems to provoke anxiety. Stepping over some invisible line, according to the journalist Lin Gu, or even discussing openly where the line might be, can get historians and newspaper editors into trouble.
If you meet up with people working inside the system, obviously, for fear of losing their jobs, the yearning to secure their position and even climb up higher, they would choose silence as a convenient tactic to protect themselves.
In one notorious case, a newspaper editor was sacked for publishing an article on the 1900 Boxer Rebellion, the revolt against the growing foreign presence in China that's conventionally taught as a patriotic and heroic movement. The history professor who wrote the article took a different view, seeing it as both anti-Confucian and anti-Chinese. Chao Mu, professor of international media studies, explains that despite China's economic reforms, the government's tight control of the media ensures that public discussion of history stays well within the bounds the Communist Party sets.
You know, this year, or last year, is the 30th anniversary of Chinese opening up and reform. You can find many other industries field have been opened for the private and foreign investment. Only the media didn't open, still tightly controlled by the government or the party, the propaganda department of party.
So does that mean that even discussing history in the media or in universities is also tightly controlled by the propaganda department?
I think orally, you can discuss everything, even sometimes on the internet, in the cyber world. But if you want to print something, you have to be censored.
The well-known anthropologist Jing Jun from Tsinghua University knows this well. His book on the politics of memory in rural China has been banned for more than a decade. He thinks history is poorly taught in China today. But first, David Kelly, visiting professor at the University of Beijing.
The history of the 20th century is the big blank. And this was, of course, one of the major criticisms made of the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, which is a tableau, was a tableau of the sweep of the 5,000 years of history. It had almost nothing to say about the 20th century. You can't use the 20th century as a representative culture. Representative culture in the sense of the things that you like to bring out and put on the table and say, this is us. Please look upon our works and take it seriously.
I don't think history is taught enough in our school system. Our school system is geared towards examination. So the history is taught in a formula. There will be the right answer, and there will be standard questions. So history is taught in my country in such a simplistic manner. So the appreciation of history has to start once you graduate from high school, probably once you come to colleges, universities like mine.
The art of censorship, though, is to keep it discreet. There may still be a strong party line, but officially history is an open field. There may not yet be an official history of the Communist Party itself, but according to the director of the China National Association of International Studies, Victor Gao, some previously banned subjects, including the Cultural Revolution, can now be discussed. As for current taboos, he says, there are very few, and everyone knows what they are.
Let me tell you what are the taboos here in China, if there are. One is the Taiwan independence. The Chinese government will not tolerate anyone talking about that. One is Tibetan independence, or the Uyghur, the Xinjiang independence. And on top of that, you know, they will not tolerate overthrowing the current-day government and the ruling party in China, either by force or by propaganda, or by whatever they consider to be undermining the what they call domestic stability and security. Falun Gong is another taboo, but other than that, you know, I think the society is becoming more and more transparent, and talking about these things themselves should not be a problem. I think there are lots of books which are now being published about the 50s, the Great Cultural Revolution, and the early part of the 1970s, etc.
This is one of Beijing's biggest bookshops on the south end of Wangfujing, Beijing's big wide shopping street, and it goes over three floors. It's quite enormous. But curiously, the modern history section seems to consist of just a few shelves tucked away on the ground floor. And it's quite an interesting collection. It's not that there aren't books, but somehow, if you're interested in something in particular and you take a book out to try to find it, it's often not there. I'm looking, for instance, there's a very impressive set of bound volumes of the history of China from 1950, 1951. This seems to go by year, but it stops in 1955. So the Great Leap Forward, obviously the Cultural Revolution, none of that is there. Then almost next to it on the shelf, there's a history of 60 years of the new China. I've had a look through that. And again, there are big absences. In fact, Chairman Mao only gets one picture that I could find. I have in my hand a history of Tiananmen Square from 1949 to 2009. This is quite interesting because it does have the Cultural Revolution. There's a famous picture of a Red Guard pinning a Red Guard armband on Chairman Mao in Tiananmen on the top of the gate. But if I go to 1989, again, I hit the silence. 1989 in Tiananmen Square, apparently the most significant things were that George Bush was there in February, and then in September there was a commemoration of the 40th anniversary for the People's Republic. Nothing in between. So the huge events of May and June in Tiananmen Square are just not here.
People don't want to look at the Cultural Revolution. It is the thing which is not there. It's not just the Cultural Revolution, going back to the Great Leap. From the Great Leap through the Cultural Revolution, it's the thing that didn't happen. People are more concerned, the story is more concerned with what didn't happen. We didn't go down in flames. We didn't lose control of the country.
In China, you can touch something we call social problem, but you cannot touch some political problem. You can say something like poverty, AIDS, HIV, no problem, for education problem, but you cannot say the political system, the communist rule of the party is wrong or got some problem.
One effect of these silences is that a student of the official history of China is encouraged to believe that all the bad things that happened were the fault of foreigners, especially the Japanese, and credit for all the good things can be claimed by the Communist Party. The terrible results of some Communist Party policies, especially in the first decades of the People's Republic, are simply not acknowledged. Take China's greatest modern secret, for example, the death of some 30 million people in the early 60s as a result of the famine brought about by the Great Leap Forward. Some people at the time were so desperate they turned to cannibalism. But this is still coyly described in the textbooks as 3 years of natural disaster.
We still know it's got a term called the 3 years nature disaster. But actually, everyone knows there's no nature disaster at all. Many people died of the hunger that time. But now in China history, the history book, or even in the mainstream media still say, oh, it's a nature disaster. It's not a human, a political mistake, or even political crime.
If we talk about the Great Famine that started in 1959 and lasted until 1961, and during that famine, probably 30 million people perished. 30 million people disappeared from the demographic record. And as for that, overseas, you have several books, but there is not a single book in China directly addressing the issue of famine and how it happened. So the Great Famine is still a taboo in history learning.
My name is Qin Chen. You know, I'm born in 1980s, so I don't know much about what happened to the China. When my parents told me about the story, they don't have enough food. So we can't believe it. I can't imagine it.
Why didn't you know about it?
The history I focus on the ancient China and not, you know, the teacher will told you about the Cultural Revolution, but very seldom.
Qin Cheng is studying for an MA in journalism at one of Beijing's leading universities. Even in this relatively open time, for her generation and for people in their 30s and 40s, the stories of the Great Leap Forward and its famine, of the Cultural Revolution with its vast public trauma and estimated 10 million dead, or of the violence and passion of China's repeated pro-democracy protests, remain obscure and puzzling.
If you look at our history book, it's all about the ancient China, the Han Dynasty, Tang Dynasty, and a very powerful dynasty. Yeah. For us, if we go to the museum, we want to know the story. But, you know, in Chinese museum, they have the exhibition. They also show how the valuable the object is.
So it's all about valuable objects and not about the story.
Yeah. I think it's a problem for me. You know, nowadays the young generation know about the sensitive history from the internet.
So 1979, democracy wall?
I think I know.
And 1989?
I think I know, but, you know, it's very hard to say.
So while Japanese atrocities are played up, Chinese atrocities are hushed up. The internal traumas of the last 60 years are unacknowledged or brushed aside in the officially sanctioned narratives. They exist only in private memories and family secrets, conditioning the behaviour and feelings of hundreds of millions of people. Lin Gu, again.
I have my own cousins who were sent to the countryside answering Chairman Mao's call to be re-educated in the countryside. And they do have their own bitter history to be buried deep side down in their own hearts. I have urged repeatedly my cousins to speak out, to even write some, or to have some oral history of what happened there, because I think if it's possible for Cultural Revolution to be forgotten, especially by young Chinese minds, so it's their duty, historical duty, to write down what they experienced themselves. My mom, nowadays, when somebody knock at our family door heavily, she could easily get very, very nervous. And that was the legacy of Cultural Revolution, because in those days, her family house was easily robbed and ransacked by Red Guards.
You can come across China's hidden history in really quite unexpected places. There is no museum to the 10 years of chaos of the Cultural Revolution, but here in the Police Museum in Beijing, just south of Tiananmen Square, there are some interesting clues. This isn't somewhere you'd expect to find a story of persecution told from the victim's point of view. Most of the displays here tell you how the state kept its criminals firmly in line throughout China's history. But in the Cultural Revolution, even the police became victims in what they now describe as a national catastrophe. As the displays illustrate, nearly 1,000 police were sent to reform through labour, nearly 10,000 were dismissed, and more than 100, including some very senior figures indeed, were persecuted to death. This is not a museum for the squeamish. Today, China's building more museums, bigger and faster than any country on earth. There are big architectural statements in the major cities that announce that China's competing on the world cultural stage. And in obscure county towns, officials are building museums to attract tourists. The Cultural Revolution is recreated as a kitsch theme in restaurants and karaoke bars. But few of China's new museums tackle the hidden history that so many citizens carry in their memories and that they re-encounter as they go about their daily lives. Antonia Finane is a historian living in Beijing who's recently written a history of China through dress.
Down the end of this street, where we are sitting now talking, down the end of this very street is the Workers' Stadium, which is used to hold soccer matches. There was an article recently about a young man whose name is quite well known as someone who died during the Cultural Revolution. His name was Yu Luoke. Yu Luoke was the child of people who were convicted of rightism in the anti-rightist campaign of 1957. Over 3 million people in China were convicted of that crime. During the Cultural Revolution, he wrote some stinging critiques of the whole practice of class struggle in its effects on someone like him, who had been a child at the time of liberation and could not possibly be guilty of rightist crimes. He was finally arrested and, with 18 others, I think, executed in front of a mass crowd in the Workers' Stadium. After his mother died, the surviving children found in her diary a reference to walking past the Workers' Stadium and how every time she walked past it, she would turn her head away so not to look. It just made me feel must be an enormous number of people in Beijing still walking around with this sense of places that they would rather never have been and the things that happened there.
In a tranquil Beijing park, where once the emperors came to pray for good harvests, groups of men and women in their 50s and 60s gather for a communal song session. They clearly love it, belting out their favourites from song sheets handed out on the spot. Many of the songs are versions of Tibetan or Mongolian folk songs. Others are the songs of their own youth. This is the Cultural Revolution generation. And whatever their individual memories, the music of that extraordinary time still seems to bind them together in the memory of a shared experience. Singing is one thing, but telling the story of the Cultural Revolution is quite another. To find the Cultural Revolution in extraordinary detail, I had to leave the silences or the veiled references in China's official museums and go far from the cities to the depths of rural Sichuan, to Fanzhenchuan's extraordinary museum cluster. It would be remarkable anywhere. In China, it's truly extraordinary. Here, in this millionaire's private passion, there are tens of millions of objects and documents, some unique, many mundane objects of everyday use that collectively add up to the most complete picture in China of daily life in the Cultural Revolution. And here on the wall of the museum, there's a blown-up black-and-white image of a young soldier in heroic pose. He's gazing at the horizon, determined to repel his country's enemies. It's reminiscent of 1,000 classic propaganda posters, but it's actually a photograph of the museum's founder, Fanzhenchuan, who at the age of 19 found himself serving in Inner Mongolia, one of the first lines of defence for the People's Liberation Army against a feared Soviet invasion. Mr. Fan told me he's always been a collector of ephemera, right from the time when, as a boy, he saved his first school reports. 40 years later, he's tens of millions of objects hoarded, and more come in every day. He houses a fraction of them in the 15 museums he's already built and plans to open a dozen more. They're all designed by celebrated architects and their subjects are diverse. The story of US assistance to China in World War II, for example, or the treatment of Chinese prisoners of war by Japan. Within a month of the 2008 Sichuan earthquake, he'd opened a museum dedicated to the event. He has millions of pieces of Mao memorabilia, from badges to teapots and posters. He has private letters and diaries, newspapers, photographs. I asked him how he'd come by the hundreds of framed marriage certificates from the 60s and 70s. Most of China's moved house in the last 30 years, he said, things get thrown out. But even the extraordinary Mr. Fan has to curb his enthusiasm when faced with official restrictions. He's not been allowed to open a planned Great Leap Forward museum, and his three museums dedicated to the Cultural Revolution are called, rather more neutrally, the Museums of the Red Age.
It was difficult for me to do this. I am the only person in China who is doing this, and I have had to be really cautious about it. I had to make compromises with the local government, for example. I promised them not to build any museum about the armed struggle or about the problem of suicides during the Cultural Revolution time. I simply could not work on these types of museums at the moment. The local government and the central government certainly would not permit it. And I suppose that I don't allow myself to try and establish such material. So at present I am preparing new museums on the re-educated youth and a ticket and certificate museum. And of course, I will need government permission before being allowed to open.
This is one of three museums in this site dedicated to the Cultural Revolution, and it powerfully takes me back to the times of upheaval and deep austerity in the early 70s when I was living in China as a student. There's the heroic music played over the loudspeakers and their background to this extraordinary collection of found objects and recreations of life, which come in vivid and detailed tableau. Every object of daily life carries a slogan, a political message, and to buy anything, from food to essential cotton, you needed coupons, which are also on display. Even human urine and excrement were subject to a coupon regime. They were used as fertilizer, and they were covered by official rules, they were rationed, and there was punishment if you didn't deliver. For a foreign visitor accustomed to the open discussion of history, it's perhaps hard to appreciate the significance of Mr. Fan's passion to document some of the cruelest episodes of China's recent past. His museums are creating waves in China for the way they've pushed back against official silence. There were not many customers when I visited in a chilly midwinter week, and perhaps for good reason the museum is off the beaten track. Even the charismatic Mr. Fan, who made his millions in property development and who once served as a city mayor, is careful not to push too hard. As in the official museums, the objects are left to tell the story. The messages are coded in displays if you know how to read the code. In one, for instance, a series of New Year newspaper front pages documents the growth of Mao's dangerous personality cult. But why does Mr. Fan think it's so difficult openly to discuss China's recent past?
Actually, I don't think this is a problem just in China. America has not got a museum to the attacks on September 11th, for example. Out of consideration for security, and especially the security of a dictatorship, it's normal for central government to consider this. I don't want to disturb the calm that people might feel. The Cultural Revolution is too close to today, and people who killed others and beat people during this time are still alive. They are mostly aged between 55 and 65. What I might do could influence their rights and impact on their lives, and I really don't want to do that. We must learn from this history, but I don't want my museum to disturb the social order. We cannot face another revolution. I don't want to see more demonstrations. I don't want to see more bloodshed. All of this has been witnessed during the Cultural Revolution, and I don't want to see it again today. I have seen the suffering, and I do not want to see it anymore.
On this open terrace, there's a series of large glass rectangles covered with 2,000 red handprints that look as though they've been printed in blood, though actually it's paint. These are the hands of the Chinese veterans of the War of Resistance against Japan from 1937 to 1945. And nearby, in another part of this museum complex, there's the story of those who didn't survive, the many, many thousands of Chinese prisoners taken by the Japanese and enslaved or murdered by their captors. Grim images of Japanese soldiers beheading them, bayoneting them. It's a powerful and it's a moving display, but it also speaks to a continuing anger and a sense of past crimes that still burns in the Chinese memory. If Chinese atrocities are difficult to discuss, the crimes of other nations against China are documented everywhere. In particular, as China's economic power has grown to challenge that of Japan for preeminence in Asia, so have the museums dedicated to the Japanese occupation of China and the atrocities committed. Museums like the Nanjing Memorial Museum are China's equivalent of Western Holocaust museums, and they're part of Mr. Fan's story too. One of his favourite objects, he told me, is a white cloth given by a father to his son to be used either as a bandage if he was wounded by the Japanese, or in the event of worse, as a shroud. It's all told as a patriotic epic in which China heroically resisted Japan. Chiang Kai-shek, once airbrushed out of the anti-Japanese war, is now given his due. But the role of the United States or other nations in Japan's defeat is barely mentioned. And there is a dark side in many personal memories too, the anthropologist